This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Remember when former Governor Jody Rell instituted a travel ban for government officials outside the state? She said it was to save money, but critics said it kept Connecticut from being competitive globally. When he took office, Governor Dan Malloy made it a point for him and his administration to go talk to people, to go sell the state, places from Davos to D.C. But this week, a new religious freedom law put one state on the no-fly list. Governor Malloy led a charge, since followed by other politicians, to boycott Indiana, citing their discriminatory and, in Malloy's words, stupid Hoosier law. We'll be talking about that, and we'll consider a new trip that many Hartfordites never could have imagined. Yes, imagine hopping on a sparkling new bus and taking a ride to Newington. Yes, the future is here, and its name is Fast Track. Those are just a few of the stories we'll tackle this week in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. You can join the conversation, as always, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio, as always, is Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Tom Condon. He is deputy editorial page editor for the Hartford Courant. Hello again, Tom.
Hello, John.
And Susan Bigelow, who writes a weekly political column for CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello again, Susan.
Good morning.
So we're going to start with some news that just came out late yesterday, and something that I know Colin and Tom have been following not just recently, but for a very long time. The state Supreme Court ordered a new trial in the murder case against Richard LaPointe. LaPointe is a mentally disabled man who's been in prison since 1989 for the murder of his wife's grandmother. This interesting decision last night, Colin, it prompted a lot of, well, it sparked some interesting conversation, mostly because of a couple of very scathing dissents. Can you take us through this case a little bit? Because, again, this dates back such a long time. This is a case that a lot of us haven't paid attention to since maybe the early 90s.
Yeah, I may have to lean on Tom occasionally as we talk about this. I will have to lean on Tom. We sort of lucked out here. We booked Tom because of his expertise in transportation. But he and a guy named Alex Wood, I think, are the two leading journalistic experts on Richard LaPointe. And Tom has done just an incredibly laudable job over the years of covering this case. So Richard LaPointe has been granted a new trial. There are a couple of things going on here. One is sort of the legal argument, but I actually feel like this is a case that almost has a moral dimension to it. Almost everything about this case from the beginning has been wrong, from the way that the police handled it to the way that it moved through the trial court system. There are so many ways in which – and so, I mean, just to maybe focus on one or two of them Richard LaPointe, his confession. There were actually three confessions obtained over, I think, 9.5 hours. This is, and then the interrogation was, I think, 2 years after the crime, too.
Yes, that's
yeah.
Right. That's
so
right,
yeah. So here you have this guy, and he really is, you know, a mentally challenged man, very gullible, very pliable. These confessions were never taped. We have only the word of the police about what happened during these confessions. One of the few opportunities we have to cross-check what the two police investigators, Morrissey and Lombardo, said against what is actually known is not these confessions, but an interview that Morrissey conducted with LaPointe's wife, in which he says, and that was taped. That was taped. That's one of the few things we have on tape. And over the course of that interrogation or conversation, he says like 30 things that aren't true, and he specifically says something that he claims he never said to Richard LaPointe. In other words, what he says is that their behavior in this case could affect the intactness of their family. Their child might be taken away from them, some things along those lines. Now, he claims he never said that to LaPointe. We only have his word because the confessions aren't taped. That would constitute a threat, you know, obtaining a confession under a threat. It's one of the many ways in which this confession could have been tainted. Anyway, I mean, that's what I mean when I say there's kind of a moral dimension to this case. That's not what the Supreme Court decided on yesterday. They decided pretty narrowly. And the decision, you could call it a Strickland piled on top of a Brady. Basically, they said that Richard LaPointe had ineffective counsel. And because he had ineffective counsel, they didn't effectively pursue the question of a suppressed piece of evidence. The suppressed piece of evidence it's pretty wonky. It has to do with the notes about the burn time of a fire that might have substantiated Richard LaPointe's alibi. But in a larger way, the principle that they're invoking, the Brady principle, which is, you know, was there evidence that was suppressed? Was it material to the case? Could it have led to a different verdict? Because of that, what's ordinarily an appellate court, the Supreme Court, has to do a certain amount of fact-finding. They have to, A, look at that piece of evidence, and also they kind of have to look at the panorama of the case and say, how strong was this case? If, in fact, this piece of evidence, the evidence that was suppressed had been known, how big an impact would it have had on the case. Now, in the dissents, in particular, well, both Justice Zarella and Justice Espinosa said they're essentially retrying this case. They're just looking at everything. And they're not supposed to do that, and it's a real violation. Espinosa's defense is has excited quite a bit of comment because of the wording is intemperate. I mean, she uses words like abuse of power. I mean, she really accuses her colleagues of having, you know, really nefarious motives. And the language is blistering. And in footnote 69 of the majority opinion, a much read footnote over the last 24 hours, they sort of say, shut up, your language is unbecoming unbefitting a Supreme Court justice. We're not even going to dignify what you just said with a response. That's all buried in footnote 69. But I shouldn't be talking. Tom should be talking. This is really he's the guy in this story.
Well, it's a courageous decision here. And, I mean, what are they there for if not to prevent miscarriage of justice? That's the bigger – I mean, I think the dissenting justices, you know, missed the forest for a couple of bushes. That this was an outrageous case. Mentally handicapped guy. They bring him in. No lawyer. No recording. At least no recording for posterity. And they sweat a confession out of him. Three confessions. Now, two of them are nonsense. One of them is, well,
if
you say I did it, then I did it, but I don't remember. And then the second one is, well, if I did it, my mind went blank or something. Words to that effect. Then they fed him a more specific confession, which it turned out didn't jibe in many key details with how the crime was actually committed. You know, it was where Bernice Martin, the victim, was, and how she was strangled. I mean, some fairly key elements of this were incorrect in his confession. I mean, the procedural flaw in the whole case, the main one, was allowing the confession in. Once the confession was in, Richard LaPointe was fighting uphill. Because at the time, this is now, remember, crime 1987, trial 1992, the prevalence of false confessions was not well understood. Central Park 5 hadn't happened yet, and a whole – there have been books written about it since then, conferences and stuff. But it wasn't well known then. I interviewed the jury foreman after the trial. You know, why was he found guilty? Well, he confessed. I said, so what was the confession? He said that was at least 75% of it. And the confessions are a farce. I mean, they never should have been allowed in. And that's basically all they have. There is no dispositive physical evidence. LaPointe had a lot of bad breaks. DNA was not well understood at the time.
How is it, Tom, that we've gone this many years, though? If indeed it was so farcical, the confession, how have we gotten to this point where only now in 2015 the state Supreme Court has to order a new trial in this case?
I think that damns the justice system in Connecticut. Because everybody knew that was a lousy case. I mean, that case stunk like a three-day-old mackerel from day one. And instead of reviewing it, they circle the wagons. You know, don't talk to us about that. That one's over. And not until very recently, you know, have the courts been open to seeing that, as in any human institution, they can make a mistake.
Going forward, there are a few kind of interesting things here. One question that I have is whether there will be another trial. Maybe there will be. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the current state's attorney apparatus in Connecticut, as it is currently staffed, wouldn't have brought this case in the first place. If they try to try this case now with everything that's known, it's going to be a mess. Because for all the reasons that Tom says, it's a terrible case. It's a messy case. There's a lot of malfeasance and overreach kicking around in there that's going to come out in court, particularly if – and congratulations to Mr. Castellaro, I think his name is, who won. But, you know, I mean, I'd like to see Richard LaPointe get a real kick-ass, like a Willie Dow-type defense attorney in this. And were that the case, this thing would be torn apart in a way that would not redound happily for the state's apparatus. And I think they know that. I think they know this is sort of not a good case. A couple other just quick things. There's also like a lot of evidence that's never really been explored. And one thing that I don't think any defense team for LaPointe has ever done is explore the third-party question. There is a third party. that there is a viable argument that somebody else did this. We know the name of the person. We know where he's sitting right now. And I don't think, for example, the pubic hair DNA has never been tested against Fred Merrill, has it?
No.
Okay.
No. And yeah, somebody was seen racing from the scene, someone who did not fit anyway. Richard LaPointe is small. He's physically weak. I mean, he probably is physically incapable of committing this heinous and raging maniac crime. 3 days after this crime, an eerily similar one was committed about 3 miles away by the aforementioned Freddie Merrill. Eerily similar. Now they weren't able to tie Merrill to it. They did try initially, but there was somebody else there. Merrill was actually, and Merrill told me he was in a bar around the corner that night.
Yeah.
Well,
Tom, before we move on from this, I just have to ask you. You'd mentioned that in these two, again, fairly scathing and intemperate dissents on the court, that you feel as though these justices are missing the forest for just a few bushes. What is it they're missing? I mean, you, Colin, many other people who've watched this case for a long time say, look, this was a bad case to begin with. We don't know all the details, but my goodness, it certainly seems as though we should have a little bit more evidence and find out more. What exactly is it that these justices, these two justices, are missing about all this?
How about that he didn't do it? I don't mean to be snide, but the court is there to prevent miscarriage of justice. Well, that's what they tried to do. That's what the majority is trying to do here. Not to hew, you know, slavishly to a technical point in the appeal process. If you do a Brady review, you've got to look at the whole case. Well, they did.
I don't want to interrupt Susan. I just wanted to say, Espinoza basically says, in blistering her colleagues, what Tom just said. She says they essentially had decided that they knew that he was innocent, and then they just constructed an argument that supported his innocence. And I mean, so that's her attack. It's less charitably worded than I just did, but that's her attack on them, that they have already decided his innocence, and now they're just making a case that fits the facts.
Right, and it seems like the underneath all the hyperbole in Zarrella and Espinosa's dissent is this argument about what the court is for, whether or not it's there to try things in a very technical way and hew to the very technical aspects of the law, or whether or not it's about justice in a larger sense. And Zarrella and Espinosa are just outraged that the court has, in their minds anyway, and I don't necessarily agree with this, but in their minds gone beyond what the scope of the court really should be.
If I could just do one little wonky thing, is at the beginning of Espinosa's dissent, she invokes John Rawls. John Rawls is probably the greatest living philosopher of justice in the English-speaking world. And she evokes a very sort of structural part of Rawls's works. But Rawls would be with Tom Condon and Susan Bigelow on this. In other words, if you know the totality of Rawls's work, his notion is justice is fairness, and fairness can't exist unless the rights of the weakest members of society are taken into account and made on a level playing field with everybody else. So, I mean, John Rawls, who's alive and living in Lexington, Massachusetts, I mean, you could kind of do a Marshall McLuhan, Woody Allen thing, have John Rawls show up and say, no, don't you dare invoke my work in this particular argument. That's absolutely not what I think.
To put a period on this, we got a tweet from Gideon's Trumpet who says, courts are far too invested in finality and procedure than the interests of justice. You can continue this conversation if you want to tweet us at Where We Live. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, Tom Condon of the Hartford Courant, Susan Bigelow, who writes a political column for CTNewsJunkie.com, in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Moving on to another story, Connecticut College canceled classes on Monday to hold a forum after racist graffiti was found on the campus. The Day of New London reports that police in New London are now getting involved after, quote, reports of harassing phone calls and derogatory racially based comments made to a custodian. This came after the controversy erupted regarding Facebook comments made by a professor who compared Palestinians in Gaza to a rabid pit bull. After the forum that was held, Connecticut College President Catherine Bergeron spoke to WNPR about the debate over free speech.
I stand by the right of all people to speak freely and to say freely their opinions. That is the inalienable right that our institutions must stand for.
And she also acknowledged the need to behave in civil, respectful ways. Civility on college campuses is something we've talked about before. Susan, you went to Connecticut College. You've been following this. So what do you make of this story? Because this has turned from something that we've talked about an awful lot recently where, you know, it's a question of what can you say on Facebook and also what should you really be allowed to say on a college campus these days? And it's turned into this much larger discussion that seems to have unearthed all sorts of hidden tensions on this very leafy, very expensive college campus on New London.
And I think that what's going on at Connecticut College is it's very reflective of things that are happening at college campuses all over the country right now, as especially sort of elite institutions that are trying to grapple with issues of diversity. And, you know, Connecticut College was always a pretty white place. And it certainly has gotten more diverse in the past number of years, but there's always been a very heavily majority-dominated kind of a place, and a lot of elite institutions are that way. So what you have then is you have the tension between academic freedom, which is what, you know, the Facebook post, people would claim that that's all about academic freedom and being able to express your opinions, and the need for colleges to create a safe space for all of their students. And that's not just a philosophical argument. It's a good thing that they really do need to create these safe spaces, but it's also a financial thing because the demographics of America are changing, and students are not going to be as white as they were in the past. They're not going to be as male as they were in the past. If institutions like Connecticut College want to survive, they know that they have to attract a diverse pool of students.
But part of this is about diversity. This is something we've talked about in the newsroom a lot, Colin, in the last couple of days. As our reporter David DeRoche has been doing a great job covering this, there's the questions of diversity, but there's also the questions of what you should be allowed to say in the context of a college classroom, or even on Facebook commenting on your thoughts about what happens in a college classroom. Diversity on one hand versus a diversity of opinions on the other hand, and that's something that seems to be rubbing up against one another in what is sometimes a very cloistered environment now of a college campus where people feel very protective of themselves in tiny little bubbles. I mean, this is, I think, part of the issue right here. We're dealing with some tensions maybe we haven't seen in the past.
Right, and I think that the idea of and there's sort of a trope out there that students are so sheltered and they need protection. And no, that really isn't what's being talked about here. We're talking about students being able to go into a classroom and not feel belittled or feel ignored or feel like the dominant paradigm power system is kind of sitting on them in a place where they should be able to learn. So there is, yes, people should be able to express their opinions, but if they express opinions that reinforce systems of oppression, that's trouble. And that makes a college campus less safe and attractive, and it drives students away, and it should.
Colin?
Well, I mean, so what are we talking about here? We're talking about a professor named Andrew Pessin who – it's kind of interesting. Andrew Pessin and Lena Dunham in the space of about 10 days got in trouble for the same thing, comparing a Middle Eastern minority to dogs. She wrote a piece called Is This About My Dog or About My Jewish Boyfriend? He did the opposite. He compared Palestinians or maybe Hamas to dogs, specifically to an attack dog, a pit bull. He did this on Facebook. He didn't do it in a classroom. He didn't do it in a scholarly paper. This is one of these things where I hear about the controversy and then I go back and I read the original offending text, and I'm kind of shocked that it caused such a controversy. I mean, first of all, you could read – I don't agree with Pessin. If he and I were to sit down and have a conversation about the Middle East, we wouldn't get along. But, I mean, I think we could also have a rational, decent conversation, which is kind of what college is supposed to be for. You're supposed to sit down and talk with people at times whom you don't agree with and sharpen your own mind against the whetstone of their opinions. And you know, here – he could certainly argue that, and he has argued, that he was talking about Hamas, not about Palestinians in general, and then he was using an attack dog as a metaphor. He wasn't saying Palestinians are dogs. He was saying, this is an attack dog. If you let it loose, here's what's going to happen. To me, this, and the fact that it was on Facebook too, it just kind of all falls within the spectrum of tolerable speech. The notion that the campus had to be shut down or at least transformed into this soul-searching, navel-gazing, you know, day of contemplation about what to, it just – I don't agree with Andrew Pessin, but it seems like a kind of a routine thing that he said.
Tom, do you have a thought, and then I'm going to go to Susan?
It does seem like – it does seem like a thing. Maybe academics, you know, should try to be dull and uninteresting so no one reads them.
they're doing a great job.
They're doing a great job.
As a rule, yeah.
the problem is that we see it in a vacuum. We don't see it in the context of historical oppression and systems of oppression that have existed for a long time. You know, it's like somebody's been poking you in the same point in the same place for 100 years, and of course that's going to be a real sore spot, real sore spot. But we only see it happen once. We don't get that. We don't have that sore spot for ourselves, so we only see it happen in a vacuum, because you know we're all white, we all have various privileges, and if you're not, if you are a member of an oppressed group, it's incredibly painful because you've been poked there for your entire life. So I don't think that it was unjustified to shut down the campus and have that day of reflection. I think it was justified, and I think that, you know, if you look at the reactions of the students, and I think we should take their opinions into account here, they said, yeah, this was the right thing to do because it showed that the administration is serious about actually listening to students and doing something about this.
Colin, do you have just the last closing thought on this?
Well, a parallel to this, you know, Bruce Shipman was driven out as the chaplain, Episcopal chaplain of Yale, for comments that people judged anti-Semitic. And so this guy is like off on medical leave now for comments that have been judged anti-Palestinian. I really do think campuses – I mean, I'm glad it's a teachable moment for the president and that they can have this conversation about it. But really, I would argue in favor of a broader ring in which people, you know, can just have these conversations without it turning into, like, I don't know, Yale got shut down because of the Black Panther trial 45 years. I get that. You know, I don't get stopping time at Khan College over this particular
thing. But there's always a question. If you stop time and actually have a serious, deep discussion about something important, maybe that's not such a bad thing to do because there's an awful lot of other reasons why you might shut down a college campus. I don't know, because you were I don't know, drinking too much and turning over cars, which has happened periodically on college campuses in the past. Maybe this is a better use of time. Let's take a break there as far as our use of time. There's a lot more to talk about, including some transit-oriented development conversation coming up. We talked about that yesterday in the program. And also, Fast Track is off and running. We'll get a little detail on that. And we'll also talk about the travel ban to Indiana. That's all coming up here on The Wheelhouse and Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We're joined by Susan Bigelow, who writes a weekly political column for ctnewsjunkie.com, Tom Condon, who is the deputy editorial page editor for The Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What, pray tell, is on your show today, Colin?
Smile, though your heart is breaking. We're doing a show about smiling, and we're specifically going to talk to a guy who, because of Bell's palsy, he lost his ability to smile.
Oh, wow.
He wrote a fascinating essay about that for The New Yorker. But we're going to talk also about the history of the smile, La Gioconda, the Mona Lisa, her enigmatic smile, and the biology of the smile, too.
Excellent. So smile this afternoon and listen to 1 o'clock on the Colin McEnroe. Now, yesterday on Where We Live, we spoke with lawmakers and transportation advocates about a bill in the state legislature that would create a transit corridor development authority. One of the politicians speaking out against it is State Representative Gal Laviele, who is on our show. She's worried about transparency and the power the state will have in town decision-making. Later in the day, during a news conference, Governor Dan Malloy was asked about some of her concerns.
We're not giving a quasi any power that a state agency doesn't currently have directly. This idea that she somehow found this, first of all we're doing is saying that a quasi would have the same power as the agency it's there to support and to finance. That's all. So this debate that's ongoing is, quite frankly, made up. And is being exploited by folks with respect to this issue. The Department of Transportation can already do that. The Department of Housing could already do that. Other state departments could already do all of those things already. So there was no grand plan, and quite frankly, never crossed anyone's mind because it's a power that currently exists.
And Governor Malloy there is talking, when he talks about a quasi-public agency, which is what this Transit Corridor Development Authority would be. The original bill, Colin, essentially said that this authority would have have an eminent domain power, be able to take over the town of Darien if it wanted to redevelop around the train station. That has now since been changed in the substitute legislation, but indeed there still are a lot of concerns voiced yesterday in the program. What's some of your takeaway from this? You were live tweeting during our show yesterday.
Yeah, that was a great show. I was having a lot of fun. But I want to specifically address what the Porcupine just said there. So here's the problem. What the Porcupine said would be true if there were no history of quasi-publics in Connecticut, if we had nothing to base this on except, you know, maybe just sort of what's there on paper. But we know what happens, and it's not a mystery, and I'll give you a specific example. So CRRA, which is another quasi-public, you know, there have been multiple attempts to get information, the kind of FOIable information you should be able to get out of CRRA. And they always fight it. They go to court. They go to the FOI commission if they can. They'll go to court if they have to. And in particular, one of my reawakened memories involves John Rowland in 2002 when they were trying to get information from CRRA about, I think, the Enron deal. And what John Rowland said, I just feel like I'll hear Dan Malloy say something like this. CRRA was refusing to give up the information. And John Rowland said, I don't have any control over them. You know, I can't tell them to give up the information. They're not under my control. I can't make them do this. Now, this being John Rowland, he was probably lying, but I mean, but that's the argument that comes up. You know, I mean, they say what Malloy says here. Oh, no, it's just like a state agency. It's going to run with all the same rules as a state agency. You know, it's going to have the same level of transparency. The quasis, they're fine. But then when you want to know something, they say, oh, well, it's not. I'm one of my agencies. I don't have any control over it. I'm sorry. I can't compel them to do this.
Yeah. Susan?
And you can't blame people for being a little nervous when we talk about eminent domain and quasi-public agencies. I mean, I think immediately of the New London Development Corporation and the famous case about taking land down there. So, you know, you can't blame people for being a little antsy about that.
Yeah. And, of course, the original bill, this is something representative from the OPM called up on the show and was essentially making that argument, Tom, that, you know, the eminent domain piece is no longer in this bill, but it was in the original bill, and that's why we're talking about it in this way. People get really, really nervous whenever, including consumer advocate commuter advocate Jim Cameron, whose house would be taken by eminent domain if indeed it could have been. You know, people get concerned about this.
Oh, sure. I mean, look, the overall goal here is a good one. The overall goal here is to try to encourage development in the transit corridors within a half mile of the commuter rail and busway tracks. That is a good thing. That it cuts down transportation costs, cuts down pollution, is good for the economy, it's good for access. For a whole lot of reasons, it's a good one. The challenge here is how to get there. And there's a model out there that would work if they can get to it. And it's something like the Connecticut Development Authority, or CERDA, Connecticut.
I don't know. They changed their name a couple of years.
Yeah, there's a lot of these.
CERDA.
It's hard to keep.
It used to be CEDA, now it's CERDA.
But yeah. CERDA in Connecticut Economic Resource. Anyway, that in which the state partners with the towns. They agree on transit-oriented development projects. And then the state buys in, puts some money into it. I mean, the state can't do eminent domain here, but they can say where they put the state's money. And they do that in the state's plan of conservation and development, too. I mean, state agencies are supposed to try to discourage sprawl. But what we're getting in the state still, despite, 10 years of attempts at smart growth, is still sprawl. We're still, I mean, the small towns are still plowing up cornfields and building suburban subdivisions. So the thrust here is good. The question is how to get here without scaring everybody's pants off.
Well, and part of it is the scaring everyone's pants off, Colin. I mean, another piece of this really has to do with, you know, what is in it for the state. An argument that came up yesterday is, you know, the state gets to develop around these, working with the towns, maybe not using eminent domain. But if what's in it for the state is we want to develop this really, really great property because we want to make money, that's a very different thing than doing it in a way that's going to be good for the people who live in that town and want to walk to transit. And those are really two very different things.
Well, also, as was illustrated on your show yesterday, most of the towns kind of have development plans, like particularly around these areas. And I don't know. I mean, I'm still sorting all this through. And I think one of the issues here is that the Commissioner of Transportation, Mr. Redeker, he seems to have a view that DOT, that his agency, should just build the hardware, right? don't ask me to do anything except build track or build road. That's what we're going to do. And then somebody else is going to figure out all the Tom Condon stuff, the land use planning that goes around this. And I'm not sure that's the right way to do it. I mean, I think if the state is going to be involved, then why can't DOT, why can't whatever this, you know, Council of Hooded Figures is, why can't that be part of the DOT? Because it's just a lot more accountable that way. Why can't DOT do the land use planning part of this if the state's going to do it?
Tom, do you have a thought on that? And by the way, it's not officially called the Council of Hooded Figures.
No,
I just want to make sure we didn't.
I'd like to point out to Susan that the New London Development Corporation is now called like the Renaissance City Happy Club or something. They do change their names a lot. So
I think it's Ziggy Marley in the the DOT does have at least nominally a transit-oriented development office. But, I mean, the planning has never been Connecticut's strong suit. It's almost non-existent. There ought to be coordinated land use and transportation planning because they're both part of the same thing. And Colin's right. How to get there is a bit of a challenge.
Of course, one of the big challenges is how we raise money to do any of this stuff, especially in a state of permanent fiscal crisis, as we like to continually call it.
Sure.
Now, there's another bill proposed by Senator Martin Looney. It's called Senate Bill Number 1, which includes a proposed car tax that would allow the state to redistribute revenue. The bill would allow regional councils of governments to collect certain taxes and redistribute this revenue. And some say this sounds an awful lot like county government for the first time. Looney says it gives towns an incentive to cooperate. There's a lot of people questioning all the stuff that's in the Senate Bill 1, Susan.
That's true. And certainly, we're once again back to the idea of the car tax. And of course, municipal leaders are up in arms because they don't want one of their sources of revenue taken away. But again, we're still bumping up against the idea that the car tax is an incredibly regressive tax, that somebody in Greenwich pays so much less for their car than somebody in Hartford does. So the idea is that they want to make this more equitable, have a statewide tax, and then redistribute it through some method, through the Regional Council of Governments. People are not happy about this because a lot of towns think, well, we're going to lose our sources of revenue.
And tax equity on one hand probably makes a lot of sense. You look at those numbers, Tom, you say, no, Greenwich paying a lot less than Hartford or Bridgeport. But then on the other hand, the Councils of Governments redistributing wealth sounds an awful lot like something, well, maybe it's the Council of Hooded Figures Colin was talking about before.
Bulletin. That's what we do now. This was attacked. Somebody, one of the Republican state senators said, this sounds like a redistribution of wealth. 51% of Hartford's budget comes from the state. Bulletin, we're redistributing wealth now. This would be a way of doing it. This would be a way of doing it without having an inequitable car tax. Now, I think it's a good thing to tax cars. You know, cars cause a lot of public expense in many and much more so than is realized. But they ought to be taxed fairly and take it from there.
Susan?
The whole big issue here is one of local control, and that's sort of the issue with the quasi-public agency as well. The towns want to have control over what goes on within their borders, even though a lot of their money, like Tom said, is coming from the state, even though a lot of the regulations are all state regulations, towns want to have control over this. And that's really the big issue here is the towns feel like they're losing control.
I'm guessing this thing is dead on the launching pad, but it's an important conversation to have for all the reasons that Susan and Tom are illustrating. And I don't have anything more to say about it other than my usual crypto-Marxist take, which is that, you know, you can either have a system of winners and losers, and that's what we have right now. So if you live in Greenwich and you're Tom Foley and you have a flying car and you pay $2,000 taxes on it, you're a winner. You won, all right? And if you live in Hartford and you've got, you know, a 74 Toyota and you're paying $8,000 taxes on it, you're a loser. You lost. Too bad for you and too bad for everybody who lives in Hartford and needs the tax base in Hartford to function and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's sort of the question. Do you want to have winners and losers or do you want to have Rawlsian fairness? And I think I know which one we're going to pick.
I mean, maybe we should call him and just have him show up here sometime, Colin. You know, you're talking about that 74 Toyota that people might have in Hartford. After years of debate and construction, maybe they don't need to drive that car if they want to head out toward Newington or New Britain. Now there's a brand new way for them to get places faster. It's called CT Fast Track, and it's actually bringing people together. Let's listen.
I'm a big fan of the bus. story.
Yeah, we've been arguing about it.
We've been arguing about it. So now that it's open, I'm dragging her along, saying, look at how much fun it is.
This is Will Cook and Cindy Prescott, two friends trying out CT Fast Track together this weekend at the New Britain bus station. Our own Kion Wolf, who engineers our program, actually took the Fast Track since it opened. Kion, what did you think? Did you like it?
I did like it. It was clean. It was really cold on Saturday night when my marching band, the Hartford Hot Several, got on and all our instruments. So it was really cold and it was really warm in there, which was nice.
Can you ride if you're not part of a marching band?
You get on free, at least for the next couple days if you're in a marching band and anybody else. But yeah, I got on, I blinked my eyes at the bus driver and I said, do you mind if we serenade you? And he said, sure, fine. And we got on and it was cool because people would hop on at different stops and we'd be playing a song. There was one group of young women who came on, so we played Foxy Lady. And it took about four songs to get from Travelers.
To get thrown off.
Okay. So about four songs to get from Hartford into New Britain?
Yep, and then we got off at that big main station in New Britain and played a few songs there at the stop and then got back on and did it again.
Well, we can't promise that there'll be a marching band on the bus with you when you take it yourself, but Tom Condon, the first 9 days of service or so are free. I mean, this bus was a long time in coming. What do you think?
Oh, I think it's a game changer for Hartford. I think it is a really positive move. Cars take up space. I mean, think about how much space you need for your car on the highway and your driveway and on the roads and stuff and parking lots. Huge amounts of space have been sacrificed for cars. Well, the highways are filling now. I mean, it is a matter of physics. I was on I-84 last night, inching along at rush hour. I don't know why I was there, but you just can't keep doing this. We got to come up with alternatives, and alternatives that don't use as much energy and cause as much pollution. Well, we've got one, and I hope everybody tries it.
Susan.
Really what we need to do and to really reduce congestion, because if we keep building the highways and we keep expanding the lanes, all that happens is that they fill up again. And studies have shown this. If you build another lane on the highway, then, well, people are going to take their cars because they think the highway is a great way to go. So, you know, we build another lane and it fills. We build another lane and it fills. And that's just we just can't keep doing it, like Tom said. So what studies show is the way to really reduce congestion is, one, have good public transportation. And, yes, we're finally getting there. And the second thing is to have what's called congestion pricing, which is charging people to use the highways at peak times. Using those two things together, and this is what they do in Europe and a lot of places that are not the United States, and it actually does work.
And Tom?
Even some places in the United States are now doing congestion pricing. And some places have good transit.
These two things coming together. I think one of the things that we just have to get over, Colin, I saw some early reviews of the busway, and people were saying, look, I tried the busway, and then I tried to take my car from Hartford to New Britain, and I still got there faster in my car. When you have a car culture, it's kind of hard to break this mode that's the only way I can possibly get there, and saving 5 minutes is all that could possibly matter.
Well, also, I mean, I hope anyway weren't doing the crossword puzzle while you were driving your car to Hartford. So there's a lot of things you can do on mass transit that you really shouldn't do while you're driving your car. It's important to note, Connecticut hates mass transit. We've never had it. I mean, like Boston, you couldn't have Boston. I don't know what would happen to Boston if there were no mass transit. So they like mass transit because their lives are unlivable without it. We've gone so long without building any that it's like in The Exorcist when they sprinkle holy water on Linda Blair and she goes, it burns! Ah! That's sort of how Connecticut people react to mass transit. And one of the things that one sees, and I'm sure Tom has seen this too, I mean, hilariously, you'll see people who are relatively new to the debate saying, they shouldn't have built this one. They should build something that lets you get from Hartford to the airport. Well, actually, we tried. It was called the Griffin Line, and people like you beat it down.
Right.
Tom?
Here's the problem. Buses actually, have gotten a terrible reputation over the years. The state's attitude toward buses until very recently has been that they're a welfare program. And they have not treated buses as an asset. Buses are an asset. In Uruguay, they have LED signs as to when the next bus is coming, and dedicated lanes for buses in Curitiba, Brazil. And so, what have we got here? Buses stuck in the same traffic on Farmington Avenue.
It's funny. I always use the example of Portland, Oregon, having those little signs that tell you when the next bus is coming. But you're talking Uruguay. This is in Portland. This is in Portlandia.
We've got a decaying first world highway system and a fourth world transit system.
Last word, Susan?
And I think that the success of the busway now, though, people are getting excited about it. The success, I think, is that the mayor of East Hartford is now calling for Busway East, which would expand it out towards Manchester. And that actually wouldn't go on a dedicated way. It would actually do some clever things with signaling and using the HOV lanes, which is great. So I think that we're on the right track here, so to speak.
Fast track.
Of course, as all this is happening, you know what gets started today? The widening of I-84 in Waterbury. Yes, indeed. We're still widening highways no matter what we're talking about. We're talking today with Tom Condon, our transportation guru. He's deputy editorial page editor for the Hartford Current. Susan Bigelow, who writes a political column for CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McInerney. When we come back, we will consider Connecticut's governor again in the national spotlight, this time for beating up on Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana. And there's a lot of people beating up on him right now. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, changing weather patterns and natural disasters are forcing many insurers to think seriously about climate change. We'll talk with local experts to see how the insurance industry could play a significant role in mitigating the effects of global warming. And Susan Campbell will join us once again as we continue our conversation about homelessness in Connecticut. Hope you can join us. Also, tonight you can join me. I'll be moderating a discussion about police transparency in Connecticut. It's a panel we're co-sponsoring with the Connecticut Foundation for Open Government. Our guests include the Chief State's Attorney, Kevin Kane, a police representative, a public defender, and the President of Connecticut's Council on Freedom of Information. You can join us live 7 p.m. tonight, Gateway Community College in New Haven. If you'd like more information about that, you can find us on the Facebook page at Where We Live. There's a lot to talk about in just a couple minutes left. So let's start with this. We've been seeing Governor Malloy periodically get back into the news under the national spotlight. You wrote about this, Colin. The fact that he went after Bobby Jindal, of course, from Louisiana. Once again, they've had this long-running feud. He's had this long-running feud with Chris Christie and at times with other governors. And now he's speaking up quite loudly about the new law in Indiana, which many see as discriminatory toward gays and lesbians. Here's Daniel Malloy talking on MSNBC's Morning Joe yesterday.
You get the picture from who was around him when he signed this bill. There were three homophobic men standing alongside the governor. One of them had equated being gay with bestiality. That's who he invited to the signing ceremony. He knew exactly what he was doing. And when you see a bigot, you have to call him on it.
Now, last night, Malloy returned to MSNBC on Hardball and then got in this little tussle with former Republican Chair Michael Steele.
I cannot disagree with the governor more. He just needs to bring the crazy down a little bit on this. I think the hyperbole, calling people bigoted, when you know that that's not the case. I think the governor stated
very
clearly.
I'm going to stop you right there.
You're going to let me finish my point.
When you walk like a duck and you quack like a duck,
excuse me, sir. I let you do your rant uninterrupted, and you're going to let me bring some clarity and common sense to the conversation.
Okay, and all this prompted by the fact that Governor Malloy got out in front of this travel ban. Now other governors and other civic leaders are joining this ban of Indiana. So, Colin, what do you make of this? I mean, he's back doing this thing once again.
Well, just a couple of things. As we were planning the show, one thing we did was we reached out to two very respected national pundits to see if they would join us to talk about the new national visibility, the high profile that Dan Malloy has now in the national debate. And they said, what? So it may be something. I mean, and of course, the other question is he a loud voice right now arguing for the restoration of principle and the denunciation of unfairness? Or is he the guy on the CT fast track platform with a shopping bag and the dirty raincoat screaming about socialism? I mean, he kind of toggles back and forth between these two modes. And so but I will say this. Look, I know way too much about RFRA, which is the name of the act in Indiana, and we have a much milder, less toxic version here in Connecticut. There's a national one. You know, Malloy's right about one thing, which is this: the Indiana law is structured to have a purpose. And the purpose is to make it as easy as possible for someone to claim a religious burden when they're being forced to comply with a law. And it's not, he's right too, that it's not really too mysterious which laws it is we're talking about. I mean, in Indiana, they do not have an anti-discrimination statute based on sexual orientation. So, I mean, this is sort of setting up the bowling pins a certain way. I don't know that I would use the language that he's using to talk about it, but I mean, he's in detail, he's not wrong.
Susan, what's your take?
Well, I think that two things are going on here. First, yeah, I mean, the Indiana law is pretty bad, and certainly trying to get out in front and pressure Indiana into doing something about it, you know, that's a good thing, and it does seem like it's having some effect. Usually, I don't really think that these sorts of boycotts do a lot of work, but in this case, it does seem like the people, the legislature in Indiana is a little spooked by it, which is interesting. I hope that they actually pass an actual anti-discrimination bill. I don't think they're going to, but that'd be nice if they did. That would show that they're really not bigoted, that they're really just trying to protect religious freedom. Of course, the other thing that Malloy is doing here is he's positioning himself for next year because he's the head of the Democratic Governors Association incoming. And he's going to be going around the country. I mean, Chris Christie did this in 2014. He was the head of the Republican.
He came to Connecticut like 150 times helping out Tom Foley.
He had an apartment.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, it did a lot of good, I have to say. He really did a bang-up job with that. But anyway.
So, I mean, Dan Malloy is positioning himself as a Democratic attack dog for 2016. And he's trying to gain a lot of credibility for that with the Democratic base.
So how about this, Tom? As you watch our governor, in many ways, many people will say he's kind of on the side of the angels on this. He's taking the right stance, many people would say. On the other hand, here he is once again being this kind of shrill national figure, not necessarily being the governor of Connecticut so much, but as this attack dog.
Oh, there's a lesson from the Christie experience that he should take to heart. I mean, if he's out being a TV star and the budget's going down the tank, that will come back and bite him. I hate to use that term, but and so let me also say I went to college in Indiana. I have a lot of friends in Indiana. Indianapolis has been a great story, great turnaround city in the last 30 years. They've had some very good governors up until now, and this is a shame. It's really too bad.
And, of course, one of the big shames for Indiana is they're hosting the Final Four this week in college. It's Indianapolis, which is, of course, the home of the NCAA, so they try to get the basketball tournament there as often as they possibly can. One of the things, as Susan said, people might be a little skittish about in Indiana right now is, you know, we're trying to get a whole bunch of people here to spend a whole lot of money, and oh, my goodness, now all of a sudden nobody wants to show up in Indiana.
Yeah, actually, earlier this week I talked to, I think, the vice president of their Convention and Visitors Bureau, and he was appalled by this law. He does feel as though they're hitting way off the back tees. And also, I mean, Indianapolis has its own municipal anti-discrimination based on sexual orientation ordinance. It's, you know, I mean, Indiana's becoming like Germany, you know, where Berlin is very cosmopolitan, you know, and welcoming. And you get out on the countryside, and suddenly it's 1939 again. And you know, I mean, that's part of the problem that they're having. Certainly, when Charles Barkley demands with 4 days' notice that you move the Final Four to a different location because of your position on sexual orientation, you've sort of blundered off the main track of American discourse.
Right, yep. And Susan, we just have a minute or so left, but it is really interesting that this conversation that's being had, because now you start seeing people, whether it's Charles Barkley or anybody else, getting into a national conversation about rights for gays and lesbians that we haven't heard as part of that conversation before. And in this, probably for a lot of people, can only be seen as a good thing, that a lot of people are getting involved in this conversation that just we're laying out before.
No, I agree. And I think about how it was 10, 11 years ago during like the 2004 election when the climate was so, so different. The fact that now a relatively mild discriminatory law like this compared to what happened before gets passed and there is national uproar, whereas before they could pass marriage bans and no one would care. So it really does show that the time has changed quite a lot.
Tom, do you have
a very good point. Absolutely.
And I'll just say, you know, in the context of all this, you said a relatively minor law. Last night was the first time I got a chance to see The Imitation Game, and you see the story of Alan Turing and what happened to not only him but thousands, millions of other people in Great Britain over the course of dozens and dozens of years, many decades, Colin. And it really is a very different time than what we were talking about then.
Yeah, I mean, back to what I said before. I mean, we've now arrived at a point where Charles Barkley, really kind of not a torchbearer, you know, for this kind of thing from the past, you know, an unlikely torchbearer, let's say. You know, he's saying this is absolutely wrong. This is absolutely wrong. They shouldn't even have the Final Four here. I mean, that points to the evolution that Susan's talking about.
Last word?
But I think that there's a tendency for us to become complacent here, and we shouldn't, because there are still lots and lots of laws out there being proposed that restrict transgender people from the bathroom, that kind of thing. So we need to keep an eye on this stuff. It's not over.
Susan Bigelow writes a weekly political column for CTNewsJunkie.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Tom Condon, deputy editorial page editor for the Hartford Current. Thank you, Tom. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks to our producer, Tucker Ives. This is Where We Live.